and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today in this interregnum between Christmas and New Year's, as we look back on the year 2018, we'll now go to the summer of 2018, in July of 2018, for an interview with Norman Ornstein about how by the year 2040, 30% of Americans will choose 70 out of the 100 senators. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now, Norman Ornstein, a contributing writer for The Atlantic, a contributing editor and columnist for The National Journal, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research, and the author of numerous books, most recently the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitution System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, co-authored with Thomas Mann, now in an updated version, It's Even Worse Than It Was. And he's the co-author of One Nation After Trump, a guide for the perplexed, the disillusioned, the desperate, and the not yet deported. Welcome to Background Briefing, Norman Ornstein.
Very good to be with you, Ian.
And let me start with, you responded to the opinion writer in the Washington Post, Paul Wolman's essay about the current power of the current tyranny of the minority, if you will, in American politics. But let me start with Paul Wolman's tweet. In the age of minority rule, a Supreme Court justice appointed by a president who got fewer votes is confirmed by a party in the Senate that got fewer votes to validate policies opposed by most Americans. And if people think that is bad, it's going to get worse, the trend.
Absolutely going to get worse in a whole host of ways. And, you know, my response to him, which was something that I mentioned to the shock of a lot of people every time I speak about American politics, is that if you look at population by state, and the World Population Review does this annually, right now, over two-thirds of Americans live in 15 states. And with the population projections, by 2040 or so, 70% of Americans will live in 15 states. And what that means, just in terms of the Senate, is that 30% of Americans will select 70 senators, more than enough to override any vetoes, to enact treaties, to overcome any filibusters, assuming that there are any filibuster rules, but also to pass laws, obviously, that will not necessarily reflect the broader needs, desires, or will of the vast majority. And while we have a republic, and lots of people just sort of parrot back, it's a republic, not a democracy, the whole notion of a republic is that you will elect representatives who broadly reflect the public desires and will. And we're moving further and further away from that. And of course, the 30% are in states that are more rural, more poor, tend to be less educated, and certainly far less diverse than the country as a whole. It's something that should make almost every American who wants to have a system where there's a broad sense of legitimacy in the outcomes of elections and of policy very nervous.
So if we're heading to the point where 30% of the population of the country will control 68% of the seats in the U.S. Senate, or even worse, half of the population of the country will control 84% of these seats. The point is, and just in case the audience has missed the point of our conversation, we're talking about red states. We're talking about the Republicans, a minority party controlling the Senate into the future.
That's, you know, it's, I should add, though, Ian, it's not even so much about party more generally. Let me take this to another level, because, of course, as these populations move, it adds to the distortion of the Electoral College, which already gives significant weight to the smaller states. You know, from the time that we first really began to count popular votes, they didn't mean very much in the early days, 1824 was the first election where there was any real significance. And if you move that forward through 1996, 44 elections, you could argue that one of those had a clear-cut result where the winner of the presidency lost the popular vote. One out of 44. Since then, two out of five elections. The first time in 2000, of course, the most contested election in more than a century at minimum, 36 days before we got an outcome, the winner of the popular vote, Al Gore, losing the presidency by a single vote in the 5-4 verdict of the Supreme Court. But the public basically said, hey, look, we needed a resolution of this. Those are the rules. It's like a tennis match. It's not how many games you win. It's how many sets you win. And Gore himself reinforced that with his concession. But the second time it happened, this time, 3 million votes separating the winner and the loser, with the winner losing that popular vote. There was much more sense of discontent over the outcome. We're going to have more of those. The third time, the fourth time, how many people are going to believe it's legitimate? Now, if we want to look at this through a partisan lens, it's absolutely the case that states that are less diverse, poorer, less educated, more rural, are going to tend to be more Republican. But I think even more broadly, what we see is a Republican Party that's using some of these distortions in the Electoral College, the partisan gerrymandering in the House, as well as what's happening in the Senate, and adding to it a substantial dose of voter suppression through draconian laws, not just about voter ID, but also restricting the days in which you could have early voting, changing the polling places and the times of elections so that minorities have less opportunity to vote. Using those tools, with the courts aiding and abetting, to basically ensure that they can have significant control over policy, even when a clear majority of voters don't want that to happen. That's not a good development.
Well, it seems that our president is concerned about it, shall we say, or at least it gets under his skin, because at the extraordinarily craven press conference with Vladimir Putin yesterday in Helsinki, he went off and revisited the election again and talked about this great Electoral College victory. So it obviously bothers Trump, but do you think it bothers the Republicans at large?
You know, we're going to find out over time whether the vast majority of Republicans who both approve of Trump and basically change their positions to adapt to anything that he says will start to get shaken in any fashion from some of those more brutal realities. Right now, I'm not particularly sanguine.
Well, at this point, just to touch on that yesterday, because I'm sure you have an opinion and many people do you think that that could have been a turning point, that there is something stirring in the broader zeitgeist, that something, to quote Hamlet, something's rotten in the state of Denmark?
If yesterday didn't shake them, I don't know what would, and that includes shooting somebody in broad daylight on Fifth Avenue. What I did notice a bit, and I tried to look at how this was being covered across different platforms, I did notice that at least during the day, Fox News was a little more honest in terms of looking at the downsides of that utterly disastrous press conference in Helsinki that the president had with Vladimir Putin. That changed during the evening hours, and of course we saw basically sycophancy from Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson and some of the others. And, you know, I don't know how this will get filtered through a lot of people. We're seeing a different reaction from some members of Congress, although that different reaction is still relatively limited criticism, except for people like John McCain and Richard Burr. I've got to believe that at least some of the suburban audience that's been receptive to the Trump clarion call will begin to have more second thoughts now. And maybe this is going to cause at least some decline in enthusiasm from Republicans about their options in 2018. But it's been pretty stunning to see how his appeals to his base over and over again are met with an almost automatic acceptance, even when he just changes positions from what have been core Republican talking points and values, especially when it comes to Russia and dictators.
Well, his explanation today was literally the dog ate my homework. He said it really comes down to the one word, would, when I meant to say wouldn't. Now, if anybody believes that, I don't know. Tucker Carlson, of course, said that Mexico's interfered in our elections, not Russia. So we have obviously a real reality deficit here. But just back to the issue of, I think the fact that Trump exposed his weakness and cravenness and raised suspicions that even have invited the T-word treason now to be entering the political debate. Again, to my mind, that's just going to make the Democrats even lazier, or at least in the sense that they've always run on the platform, that we're not the other guy. And in this case, they've been running on that platform ever since Trump became president, and talk of impeachment, which certainly backfires. So given the fact that the Democrats have an automatic deficit of about 8%, in other words, they've got to get 8% more votes to even break even because of what we're talking about, the gerrymandering and the Electoral College. What's your prognosis then in terms of, will they get a narrative? Will they get the people out to vote that didn't vote the last time? And will this reliance on we're not the other guy work? I mean, obviously at the moment they're thinking, if you listen to what Schumer and Nancy Pelosi are saying, they're basically saying, that this guy may be owned by Putin and may be compromised. But I'm not sure that's going to move the needle.
It's an unknown at this point. That phenomenon worked for Republicans like a charm in 2010 and 2014. There was no larger message or agenda beyond elect us so we can stop this Kenyan socialist from destroying the country. Now, I would give you a caveat on that, which is that what usually happens in a midterm contest, and it's what happened when there's a wave in 2010 and 2014, is that the president's party is disillusioned and depressed and stays home, and the opposite party is angry and turns out. But we're so driven by negative partisanship now that Trump's appeal to Republicans, it's not about me, it's about keeping those evil people from taking over, might get a larger turnout. That's one part of it. But the second part of it that we have to keep the focus on, laser-like focus, is what the Russians will do in November. I will tell you, Ian, I haven't seen any thorough analysis of some of these things. But when almost 200,000 votes in Los Angeles County during the primary were basically invalidated because of what they said was a glitch in the system, something I've never seen before with numbers at that level. And that was followed a few weeks later by 80,000 votes in Maryland through what was called a mistake in the Motor Vehicle Administration. It made me wonder whether these are beta tests by Russia in blue states where people aren't going to pay as much attention to resuming their interference in the elections in November. We know that they have, at minimum, they were able to purchase through a company Maryland's voter registration lists. We know that they tapped into the voter registration lists of other states. If you do that and you change a middle initial in some of the names, or reverse a couple of the letters in the name, or change one digit in the last four of the Social Security number, you can end up with large numbers of people who are told when they go to the polls, no, you're not registered. And some of them are just going to go home. Others may say, I want to file a provisional ballot. And those provisional ballots will get counted in California and Maryland. But if this happens in Ohio, or Florida, where you have Republican election officials who have deep sixed provisional ballots before, that could change the outcome of the election. And whether anything can be done about it remains to be seen. And we certainly haven't seen any sense of urgency in Congress to deal with this problem. And I find that particularly troubling right now.
Well, just a final reality check in the last minute. Isn't it true that the Democrats have got to take the House and the Senate, and particularly state houses, in this upcoming election in November in order to reverse gerrymandering with the 2020 census? And by the way, they're stacking the census by trying to discourage minorities.
I think there's no doubt that this is by far the most significant midterm election in our lifetimes. And if Democrats do not find it an ability to take at least one house of Congress, God knows what kinds of laws will follow.
Well, Norman Ornstein, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Absolutely, Ian. Good to talk to you. Thanks.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Norman Ornstein, who's a contributing writer for The Atlantic, a contributing editor and columnist for The National Journal, and a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He's the author of numerous books, most recently the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, co-authored with Thomas Mann. Now, in an updated version, It's Even Worse Than It Was. And he's the co-author of One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. And you've been listening to a Norman Ornstein from an interview back in July of 2018. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with more of 2018's summer programs from Background Briefing, an interview with Lance Dodis about whether Trump is becoming increasingly unhinged.
We ain't going to the town.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Lance Dodis, a training and supervising analyst emeritus with the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute, who was a clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Dodis is a contributor, along with 26 other psychiatrists and mental health experts, who have contributed to the recent book, Assessing President Trump, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lance Dodis.
Good to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Lance. And there have been some leaks from inside the White House that President Trump is increasingly isolated, doesn't really listen to anybody, and is just acting impetuously because he watches television and then he has to react all the time. That he's not really governing, he's kind of, I refer to it as government by stunt, where on a daily basis he pulls off these reality TV stunts. Like, for example, the sudden invitation to Putin to come to Washington in the fall at the height of the campaign. That's the last thing the Republicans want. Is to be reminded of Russian interference in our elections just before the election. But yet Trump did this because he was apparently watching TV and got angry at the director of national intelligence, Dan Coats, making remarks that he thought were disloyal. So he immediately tells his national security advisor to shoot out this invitation. And then, of course, the NBC reporter revealed it live in her conversation with the DNI, Dan Coates. So that's an example of real-time, impetuous, geopolitical insanity.
Yes. You know, what can I say? Many of us have predicted this from before the election, because if you see Donald Trump not as a normal human being like almost everyone else on Earth, but you understand that he has a very severe psychological deficit, namely that he's a sociopath. It's also called antisocial personality disorder. Once you see it that way, then it all makes sense. As an effective con man, you remember the mayor of New York, what was his name, Bloom? He spoke at the Democratic National Convention.
Mayor Bloomberg, yeah.
Yeah, Mayor Bloomberg, who was a Republican, who said Trump is a con man, and that's right. So people have trouble accepting that he is so different from normal. So it's one shocking thing after another if you don't see it that way. But if you do, then it all makes perfect sense, and we can all predict the future once you accept that. He is unable to empathize, genuinely empathize, with others. He's certainly able to fake empathize with others, as he does. That's how he got elected. He says, I'm going to make all of you people great, same technique that Hitler used in Germany in 1932. But it has nothing to do with them. It all has to do with him. The allegations, multiple allegations, I think you were just talking, referring to, of his money laundering for Russian oligarchs and Putin, make perfect sense. I mean, this is a man who is doing things for himself and only himself, and the fact that he lies or the fact that he is impetuous fits with that, because his contact, to speak specifically to your comment about his impetuosity, he is in loose contact with reality when reality is a challenge to him. So when things are going well, he can appear magnanimous and he can appear friendly and all of that. But if he's challenged, he can't accept challenges. He can't accept any way in which he would be less than wonderful and omnipotent and omniscient. So he has to lash out. He has to. It's not a question of a deliberative matter for him. He doesn't consult with others. He doesn't think about the long-term consequences. He thinks only about what he needs to do to protect his own sense of his grandiosity in the moment. He's been forced to retract on various occasions, and usually the way I've seen it is they tend to be things written for him, which he then reads, and it's completely different from the way he speaks and acts when he's not reading somebody else's material. But it all makes sense, sadly. That he would unravel under the pressures of having to listen to other people, pay attention to what other people need, conflict, so forth, it's not only was predicted, but it will get worse, as we're all saying it. My greatest worry is that as the Mueller investigation proceeds and he becomes more and more trapped, as Republicans, in order to save their own skins, begin to abandon him, that's when I think we will be at maximal risk of his starting a war or attempting fundamental change in democracy, denying the Supreme Court's power and all that kind of thing. Sounds outrageous, but it would be consistent with him.
And again, I'm speaking with Lance Dodis, who's a training and supervising analyst emeritus with the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute, who was a clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Dodis is a contributor along with 26 other psychiatrists and mental health experts who have contributed to the recent book Assessing President Trump, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. Well, of course, the excuses he's given are really in the category of the dog ate my homework. He meant to say
right.
Wouldn't instead of would. Why anybody would believe him is beyond my understanding. But the fact that he on a daily basis is trying to stay one step ahead of the sheriff, and it's obvious that he's deeply guilty and he's coming up with all kinds of daily stunts to distract the press and also to feed his base, which so far has seemed to be sticking with him. That my sense is that it's like he's under this pressure of you can correct me on this, of narcissistic mortification. In other words, that's the worst thing that could happen to him is reality intrudes to the point where he has to recognize that he's a complete amateur and a complete incompetent, and he's making a complete disaster of the presidency.
Well, I think that is absolutely true. For a very long time, people have been accurately diagnosing him with narcissistic personality disorder. But if he only had a narcissistic personality, that wouldn't be so bad, frankly, because there are a lot of people with grandiose visions of themselves, and some of them actually do some good. Some of them have been presidents in the past. But he is sicker than that. There is a fundamental kind of emptiness inside of him, a lack of ability to understand reality when it differs from his view, and therefore a lack of empathy or real concern for anyone else. That's not true of all people with narcissistic personality. So that's why a more accurate term, it's not that the other is wrong, but a more accurate way to describe him is as a sociopath, I believe. It is terrifying. I think he's unique. I think Nixon had some of that, and maybe in a different time period, Nixon would have been somewhat similar. But I think Nixon was a manipulative con man, but not as deeply troubled as Trump.
So, given that Trump craves the acceptance of Hollywood and the celebrity culture, which he really wants to be a part of. And the other day, by the way, he was addressing a group in the White House. I can't remember what they were talking about, job training or something unrelated. He then went off on this, off the teleprompter and talked about The Apprentice. Oh, that was a great show, And he almost was wistful about when he was a celebrity, or at least in his own mind. So if he's so desperate for approval, and as you know, Lance, Hollywood celebrities despise him, and he can't really claim too many stars on his flocking to his banner. So, is there a level? Is he capable of humiliation? In other words, that to my mind would be the worst thing that could happen to him. The fact that he's afraid that he's not being, or upset that he's not being adored, even though he said your favorite president in the recent tweet. Is it possible that also could be? Let me ask you that: could he be? Can he? Is he capable of being humiliated?
Well, that's a great point, because I think that goes to the heart of what I was trying to say. That I think he is capable of being horrified and massively existentially threatened by being humiliated. But whether he actually feels humiliated, I think if he could feel humiliated, he would be a healthier person. But I think it's exactly at that point that he distorts reality. He loses touch because he can't do it. So since he can't stand that, he just changes the reality so it isn't occurring. People who are critics of him are lying. It's fake news. So as the pressure increases, I think, and this is the same way, it comes to the same issue, as the pressure increases and as his humiliation is as a complete failure as president and a failure in multiple ways, as that increases, he will distort reality more and more. For example, it would be consistent with him. Again, I'm not predicting this. But how do you think he could be removed from office? What if the Congress impeached him? He would be in a rage. He would do whatever he has to do to deny and prevent this from happening. And if the Senate ever convicted him and he was thrown out of office, I don't know how you'd get him out of the White House, I mean, he would invent a crisis. So I'm not trying to be an alarmist. I'm just saying that I think that when you're absolutely right, he can't stand it, and he will do anything to change it, including changing reality. He's in a position of power to change reality to suit him, which is what's so terrifying.
So, what about the 25th Amendment? Does the same problem apply to that?
I think so. I think that it's hard to imagine how he would be if he got cornered completely. Mm-hmm. I mean, in his own businesses, as you were pointing out, when he has to deal with other people, it's a different story. He's an oligarch, he's a dictator, he's a tyrant in his own businesses, and no one can stop him because he owns them. We're seeing now that perhaps he owes the Russians because of their supporting him financially. But it's hard to imagine. There was a movie, the salesman is finally, who's calm and smooth throughout the whole movie, finally gets trapped, and he has basically a psychotic episode lying on his bed. I can't remember the name of the movie now at the moment.
Glengarry, Glenn Ross, was that what?
Yes, it probably was. Maybe. Yeah. Oh, good. Yeah, and it was a striking scene, wonderfully acted. But it's that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It's intolerable.
And again, I'm speaking with Lance Dodis, who's a training and supervising analyst emeritus with the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute, who was a clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Dodis is a contributor along with 26 other psychiatrists and mental health experts who have contributed to the recent book Assessing President Trump, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, Lance, we're talking about Trump being more and more unhinged and the idea that this he's under pressure from the narcissistic mortification of the reality of his incompetence and amateurism becoming overwhelming. But to my mind, it's not just Trump we have a problem with. It's the American people, or at least 40% of them. Why are they going along with this? Why are they refusing to see the obvious reality?
Well, I think it's the same as why Hitler was democratically elected in Germany. The people want a leader, not all people, but many people want a strong leader who will protect them. That's the goal. And so things like democracy are much less important to them than that. So dictators have regularly had huge majorities of people in favor of them, at least at the beginning, because that's what they say. They all say what Trump said: I will make you and your country great again. I will give to you what I personally need, which is a sense of enormous power and value and money and everything else. It's all lies, but people would like that. That would be nice, you know? I mean, we had feudalism for a long time, and there was a king, and people loved the king, as long as the king, almost no matter what the king did, because the king represented a powerful, valued person with whom they could identify. It's like a kind of hero worship, but much worse.
Well, just in closing, though, what do you think it would take to break that spell? Because he obviously panders to his base because he knows that's all he's got.
Right.
So what would break the spell?
I think that for some people, I mean, they're not all bad people who support Trump. So for some people, eventually their sense of decency and rightness and their own morality, which Trump lacks, would become more important than what they see as defending a man who represents them. He would no longer represent them because he would be too far from their own personal values. For some people, would stand by him forever. But I think that we're all hoping that the Mueller investigation finally convinces Republicans, who are actually the Republicans in office are more important than the people in a way, because they're the ones with the true power to do something, but they won't. But I think that when people finally see that he doesn't actually represent them, that's the glue that holds them to them. He represents us. He is standing for us against those bad people, whoever they are, the bad liberals who would support so-called un-Americans like blacks and immigrants and so forth. Once he stops representing what they think is them, is themselves, then I think they'll break away. And then the next crisis will be, who is Mike Pence other than, you know, the lapdog for Trump? And I don't know the answer to that one.
Well, Lance Dodis, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure. My pleasure.
And again, I'll be speaking with Lance Dodis, who's a training and supervising analyst emeritus with the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute, who was a clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Dodis is a contributor, along with 26 other psychiatrists and mental health experts, who have contributed to the recent book Assessing President Trump, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. And you've been listening to the psychiatrist Lance Dodis about how Trump is becoming increasingly unhinged. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with Ian Haney-Lopez about how Trump's dog whistles are now a howl.
And the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame. And the poor white remains on the caboose of the train, but it ain't him to blame, he's only a pawn in our game.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity since the publication of his groundbreaking book, White by Law. He remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America. A former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools, his latest book is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ian Haney-Lopez.
Glad to join you.
And it does seem that Donald Trump, who has been dog whistling since he started the Bertha canard with Barack Obama when Obama was president, and he put forth this idea that the president was illegitimate, he didn't have an American birth certificate, he was a Kenyan interloper and an anti-colonial troublemaker. Since he's been elected, he's intensified, but now it's almost, the dog whistle has almost turned into a howl.
I think it's important to understand what we mean by dog whistle. And I think what we're trying to get at with dog whistle is that you have politicians who are intentionally using racially charged language to animate animosity or fear and resentment in their base. But this is language that at the same time allows them to deny, at least to their base, that they're doing any such thing. And so here, when we think about Trump, I think many of us understand that Trump is engaged in racial demagoguery. But we should be clear, his base does not believe that. So there was a really interesting poll that was done week before the election, and the question in the poll was, do you think the word racist describes Donald Trump? And among Clinton voters, the overwhelming majority says, you bet. But among Trump supporters, 87% said no, and only 5% said yes. So Trump's supporters do not believe that he is engaged in racial demagoguery. They think that what he's communicating is common sense, to use a phrase that Trump himself uses an awful lot. Though I think it's very important that what's passing for common sense for them are deeply internalized racial fears and myths.
But the Bertha conspiracy that he ginned up, and basically that launched his political career, if you will, it seems to me that that Bertha conspiracy, in effect, gave Americans who were restrained by what they call political correctness
and essentially gave them permission to speak openly in racist terms.
I agree with an awful lot of what you said, except for the openly in racist terms. So listen, here you have the election of the first black president. If this were open racism, you would have heard people saying, I can't believe we just elected an N-word to the White House. That's open racism. The reason the birther claim worked so powerfully was because it was a way of talking about racial difference while using non-racial, seemingly non-racial language. So it wasn't, oh, N-word. It was, I don't think he was actually born here. It wasn't, can't stand a black man. It was, I actually think he's Muslim. And so these phrases, so half of Republican voters came to believe that Barack Obama was Muslim. Did it have anything to do with his religious practice? No. It was all about his race, but it was a way for them to express racial doubt without using racial language. So the people who were very fearful of a black man in the White House could say publicly and say internally to themselves, I'm worried about this foreign-born Muslim. It expressed profound doubt rooted in race, but the way it was expressed was not openly racist.
And again, I'm speaking with Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity since the publication of his groundbreaking book, White by Law. He remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America, a former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools. His latest book is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. So I guess the question then would be, why does it work in terms of President Trump's dog whistles? And by the way, he more or less admitted recently when he went after the NFL players, the black NFL players again, and implied in no uncertain manner that they weren't smart enough to know what they were protesting, which is really, I think, grotesquely racist. The assumption is that he did that because it works. It keeps his base on side and keeps them riled up. But why does it work?
It works because it is essentially the right-wing Republican message of the last half century. So dog whistle politics is a technique that Republicans proposed for the first time in 1963. Their candidate Barry Goldwater tries it in 64. They lose then because whites aren't, you know, haven't deeply internalized the message. By 1968, it works a little bit. By 1972, Richard Nixon's dog whistle politics, he calls it the Southern Strategy. It's a national strategy of appealing, using coded terms to appeal the racial fear, wins in a landslide. Republicans have won a majority of the white vote using coded racial messages in every election from 1968 to today. And it's not just that Republicans have been doing this, but if you think about Fox News, Fox News is 24/7 a bullhorn for messages of racial fear. So what Trump is doing is he's echoing messages that many people on the right have been listening to, have been internalizing, have been absorbing for decades. And it's in that sense he seems to be speaking to and at the same time generating these real racial fears and anxieties about changing demographics, about changing gender roles, about the appearance of transgender people, about new religions and new cultures and new languages, right? Any society has to confront questions of difference, of belonging, of curiosity, of threat. What we have is a society in which a significant element of our leadership, backed by the biggest concentrations of capital, the corporations, the big donors, the family dynasties, they've decided that they're going to purposefully stoke notions of fear and division. That's what we've been doing for 50 years, and that's the path that was so readily available to Donald Trump in 2016.
So is the purpose then of using dog whistles and using race to divide the 99% to enrich the 1%, in other words, to take the focus away from the inequality and the growing inequality as the rich get richer and the middle class is stagnant and the working Americans haven't had a raise since the 1970s. Is that the purpose?
I have a two-word answer to that. Donald Trump.
Uh-huh.
Donald Trump, a billionaire, so-called self-professed billionaire, who only really cares about his bank account and the bank accounts of people like him, just passed the largest tax cut for billionaires in the history of the country, and 90% of Republican voters still support him. Why? Because they're keen on giving money away to billionaires? No. When you look at who voted for Donald Trump, the vast bulk of people who voted for Donald Trump have family incomes between $30,000 and $100,000 a year. This is the working class, lower middle class. They are racially fearful whites who believe that the biggest problem in their lives are people of color or other poor and working class people of color, because that's what they're being told by a wealthy elite who've adopted racism as a divide and distract weapon. The rich are busy writing the rules for themselves, giving themselves big tax cuts, stacking the cabinet with other billionaires, and meanwhile, they're saying to working whites, hey, look over there, it's a black man. He might be on welfare. He's ripping off the system. Oh, hey, look over there, it's a brown-skinned man. I think he might be illegal. It is 100% a divide-and-distract weapon of the 1% against the 99%.
So what will break that mendacious spell? In other words, at what point do working class whites, Latinos, African Americans recognize that they have more in common with each other than they do with the 1% who are basically, you know, taking the cream and leaving them in the lurch?
I think that political revolution, and it is truly the political revolution that we need, that revolution can start today. I have been working with a team of pollsters and linguists and think tanks, and we just completed a study that we're calling the race class, race-class narrative project. It's been written up in The Nation, it's been written up in Salon, it's been written up at The Atlantic. The race class narrative project, and what we proved through national polling is that we have a very powerful story that can unite people across race lines into a truly multiracial class movement. And here's the basic story. They're using race as a divide-and-distract weapon. We come together in cross-racial solidarity. Through cross-racial solidarity, we take back government from the rich. And once we have control of government, we use that to create a broad and shared prosperity for all of us and to promote racial justice. 3 points: cross-racial solidarity, get government back, through government, prosperity, and racial justice. That basic narrative, those three elements, cross-racial solidarity, get government back, shared prosperity, and racial justice, that's a very powerful narrative, and we tested it nationally with over 2,000 people, and that message performs better than the standard Democratic message, which we're calling colorblind economic populism, the sort of, we're going to talk about economics, but we won't address race, works much better than that, because people know we're being racially divided, and they want politicians who are willing to name it. And it also works much better than the right-wing message of racial fear. So there's a way to talk about racism as a weapon of the rich against all of us that works today to defeat dog whistle politics and to lay the groundwork for a truly multiracial working class movement, a truly multiracial democracy, I would say.
And again, I'm speaking with Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity since the publication of his groundbreaking book, White by Law. He remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America, a former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools. His latest book is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. And earlier, Ian Haney-Lopez, you mentioned Nixon's Southern strategy. Prior to that, of course, the Democrats had the Dixiecrats, the Southern white racists. And then when LBJ signed the Voting Rights Act during the civil rights period in 64-65, he said to an aide, the Democrats have just lost the South. And sure enough, Nixon came along and proved that to be the point. So what do you do about that? If you have a kind of core, kind of atavistic part of America that, even though they say we have the new South, it's pretty clear that the Republican Party, the party of Abraham Lincoln, has become the party of the Southern racists, in effect. So how do you deal
with that? Right. There's no doubt that there are regional differences in terms of whites' commitment to the idea that being white is an important aspect of who they are and a source of pride. There's no doubt that there's regional differences. So that said, I mean, I think there are important changes happening in the South. But look, here's what's happened over the last 50 years. One change that's positive, one change that's really negative. The positive change is that the idea of racial equality has continued to spread. It has spread in terms of who we see in our culture, who we see in sports, who we see in business, who we see in politics. I mean, the election and re-election of Barack Obama is really a monumental testament to a spreading idea of equality, contested to be sure, but spreading them nonetheless. So that's a positive development. Here's a negative development. Over the last 50 years, the right has been able to use a message of racial fear to convince a majority of whites to support policies that are only good for billionaires, with the result that working people in the United States, working families in the United States, have suffered terrible losses over the last 50 years. Pensions gone, unions gone, home equity gone, healthcare unaffordable, education unaffordable. And the confluence of those two creates a moment that we've never seen in the history of the United States, a moment when it's possible to say to all America, but in a way that's especially convincing to whites, to say to them, listen, racial equality is the way forward, and racism among whites is the biggest threat in the lives of all of us, including in the lives of whites. It's the biggest threat because it's what's empowering people like Donald Trump to rip off the country. Right? And so, and that message, this message is different in 2018 than it would have been in 1968 with Richard Nixon. And the message is different for these two reasons. In 1968, the cultural and material advantages of whiteness were still very high, right? I mean, we had barely contested the idea that whites were a superior race. Most whites continued to assume they were superior, continued to feel consciously or unconsciously that being white was essential to who they were and was evidence of their goodness and all of that nonsense. And at the same time, jobs were segregated, neighborhoods were segregated, schools were segregated. There were substantial material advantages to being white. Both of those have changed. Among many whites, the sort of cultural advantage of being white, they're not invested in that anymore, or not so much, not very much. Whereas the material benefits of being white, completely swamped by the material harm of so many whites voting their racial fears. That, right? And so it's not that people see that. It's not that that's how whites are thinking about it now, but it's what we can convince people of. It's what we can say, hey, listen, you really want to understand what happened over the last 50 years? It wasn't brown-skinned or black-skinned people. It wasn't Asian Americans or Native Americans. It was the very rich, and they rigged the rules, and they robbed the rest of us. And how do they do that? Through racism as a divide and distract. That story can help switch people's perspective on what happened to them and where the threat is coming from and what they need to do to come together to move forward.
Well, you've made it very clear, Ian Haney-Lopez, how race has been weaponized by the GOP. But the other, just in closing, aspect of the GOP is that it's driven by what appears to be a totalitarian impulse. The Democrats have to win at least 8% more votes just to break even. By 2040, there'll be 70 Republican seats in the Senate because of the Electoral College and 30 Democrats. The tide is against them. they don't want just to win in a competition with the Democrats. They want to extinguish them. They want to defund them by stacking the Supreme Court with the Gorsuches and this Kavanaugh character that they want to put on, who will be the final nail in the coffin. So I'd like to get your analysis of, do you recognize that totalitarian impulse, and where does it come from?
It is. I wouldn't say totalitarian. That has a lot of baggage. It has very specific meanings. I would say what's happening is, it is crystal clear that the forces of concentrated wealth, the greedy rich in our society, are profoundly anti-democratic. They do not believe in democracy. So they're quite happy to exploit democratic processes to gain power. For example, by fooling as many voters as they can, by funding different politicians, by essentially buying votes in legislatures. They're quite happy to exploit democratic processes. But at the end of the day, they do not believe in democracy as a project. They actually see democracy as a project as dangerous to them. And so they're willing to back, and the politicians they help get elected, that they fund, are willing to back policies that effectively disenfranchise as many Americans as possible, and especially people who are poor, people who are working class, people who are young, people of color. Right? This is the politics. It's a profoundly anti-democratic politics. Why? Because the project of democracy in every society, the project of democracy is to create a sense of social solidarity, of shared belonging, of linked fate, and to push power and wealth downward and outward. Right? That's the project of democracy. That's what we mean by a democracy that cares about all its members. These folks don't want a democracy. They want a plutocracy. They want rule by the rich. And rule by the rich can take different forms. It can be totalitarian. It can be authoritarianism. The core is it can be a theocracy. They want rule by the rich. And rule by the rich is the antithesis of democracy. So they are, at root, profoundly anti-democratic, at the same time that they consistently seek to exploit democratic processes and democratic norms, and indeed even liberal values like First Amendment, free speech. It's a very, very cynical ploy. They're not interested in democratic values and liberal values. They're interested in rule by the rich. That's what they're funding. That's what they're paying for. That's what they expect to get from the politicians that they bankroll.
Well, Ian Haney-Lopez, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity since the publication of his groundbreaking book, White by Law. He remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America, a former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools. His latest book is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. And that was Ian Haney-Lopez from August of 2018, talking about how Trump's dog whistles are now becoming a howl. This has been Background Briefing. We're doing a retrospective here from the summer of 2018, and we're back again tomorrow with a retrospective from the summer to the fall.